So my talk, as you can see here, is entitled Challenges and Opportunities in Organizing Health Professionals for Peace and Justice. I'll be largely focusing on our work within PSR and here within the Peace Caucus on nuclear weapons issues, but we'll also be dealing with other issues related to those of militarism that we've been dealing with over the years. I have no conflicts of interest to report. And as indicated, my starting point on this will be discussing issues of nuclear war and how health professionals have here and throughout our country and the world have responded to them. Starting point is certainly dealing with the legacy of the twin detonations at Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Nagasaki, that by the end of 1945 led to the deaths of over 210,000 people from the combined effects of heat blast and radiation, with many people affected over the subsequent years by the more chronic effects of radiation, including genetic damage and cancer. Because of the horrors of the detonation of nuclear bombs in Japan, there was a widespread movement throughout our country and the world that's really well encapsulated by Lawrence Wittner's work. He has a three-volume history of the history of the anti-nuclear movement. This one, Confronting the Bomb, is sort of a synthesis of the three volumes and his most recent read on it. But hundreds of thousands of people, I was very humbled to place our own work over the years within the context of the really wide movement around the world that physicians ultimately became involved in as well, and basically refuting this call that's depicted here at one of the clinical symposia that we were somehow supposed to respond to the effects of the thermonuclear exchange, most likely during those times and even now in many ways between the U.S. and at the time the Soviet Union, and we took the position that this was really impossible, as documented by many of the founding members of Physicians for Social Responsibility, who in 1962 had a series of articles in the New England Journal of Medicine, The Medical Consequences of Thermonuclear War, which really underscored the futility of any such response. We didn't have enough burn beds, we didn't have enough physicians and nurses and other health professionals who would be able to survive such a thermonuclear exchange. And as a result, our organization was really founded on the central moral and ethical precepts that we had to do anything we could to prevent such a war from happening. That it was impossible to respond. And this has really remained a guiding principle, preventive medicine in this case, and preventive public health approach since the founding of PSR, and is maintained as a central core for us in much of our work on global warming, et cetera. It was efforts like PSR physicians who were collecting baby teeth to look for strontium-90 and many civil organizations around the United States and around the world that led President Kennedy in 1963 to sign the Limited Test Ban Treaty that forbade the above-ground explosion of nuclear weapons, although underground testing remained until a basic functional moratorium in the 1990s by the former Soviet Union and the United States. For these efforts, as well as the efforts of the subsequent founding of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, that was focusing on decreasing the hostility and the dangers of war, particularly in the scary years of the Reagan administration, that we were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1985. And on the right-hand side, you could see some of our founding members from right to left, Sid Alexander, still on our board, as is Vic Seidel and Jack Geiger, the latter two former presidents of the American Public Health Association as well. Despite these early years of PSR, it wasn't until 1981 that our organization, APHA, adopted our first nuclear weapons policy, calling for nuclear disarmament. And later in 1985, outgoing President Vic Seidel organized a general closing session really underscoring the need to prevent nuclear war as a major public health priority that has remained with subsequent resolutions, many generated by the Peace Caucus, a very central issue for the organization. And at the same time, our Peace Caucus was formed to organize around those issues. And the following year, in 1986, some of you may remember, we gathered in Las Vegas for the APHA meeting with all its glitter, but very significant because within 50 miles of Las Vegas is a Nevada test site. I've shown this in prior years. You could see the mushroom cloud from the nuclear test site that indicated that period of nuclear above-ground detonation of nuclear weapons that I was talking about. And in 1986, many of us at APHA gathered at the Nevada test site. About 400 of us demonstrated along with American in a session organized by the Peace Caucus in conjunction with the American Peace Test. And about 140 of us took part in nonviolent civil disobedience against this. And up on the platform were many APHA notable figures, Jack Geiger, Vic Seidel, Bill Fahey, who was the president at the time. So with all of these efforts and really the outpouring of public health professionals, I mean, PSR during the 1980s, because of these policies, we literally had chapters springing up all over the country, had 60,000 members at our peak, major public, involvement of the public against nuclear weapons. We now at least and have at the level of rhetoric in our President Obama calling for a world, to seek a world without nuclear weapons, very reminiscent of the rhetoric of Ronald Reagan towards the end of his administration after those massive demonstrations. However, we still have, despite the rhetorical support for a world without nuclear weapons, we still are faced with this almost psychedelic display put out by the Federation of American Scientists illustrating the numbers of nuclear weapons around the world, which total at this point more than 22,000, which is equivalent in explosive force of over 200,000 Hiroshima-sized bombs, 2 tons of explosive force of TNT for every human on the planet, amazing amount of overkill, with 2,000 to 3,000 ready to be launched on hair trigger alert. And I've in the past related some of the consequences of those dangers and the need to de-alert nuclear weapons, which I won't be getting into detail. We remain with not only in terms of the significant number of weapons in the American and former Soviet Union stockpile, but also the significant dangers of regional nuclear war. This is from India Today in 2002, at the time, which I got from my friend Dr. Chawla, the Indian Doctors for Peace and Development, illustrating at the time what would happen with a regional nuclear conflict, with the this very significant numbers of deaths directly related to such regional nuclear war, where it's been estimated something on the order of 20 million deaths in major cities in India and Pakistan. You know, people firing in such short distance, the radiation you would elicit in one country comes back on you as well, and this would be throughout the region. And we have more information, and Catherine Thomason presented Ira Helfand's work from PSR and IPPNW earlier this week on what we now recognize. It's not just a problem over there, but something that can affect the entire world, because when you have that type of nuclear exchange, as was underscored a few years ago in Scientific American, it has global effects. And it's basically the situation that we now face, where if you have such nuclear explosions, they'll ignite whole cities. The amount of particulate matter, soot from burning cities, would be sufficient to block sunlight, that we would basically have a period of global cooling, analogous to the issues that Carl Sagan was raising many years ago about nuclear winter, whereby this would lead to significant drops in global temperature and sunlight, where we could have somewhere in the order of 1 billion deaths worldwide from starvation because of the impacts on agriculture. And so these are issues that we have been using around the world with our international campaign against nuclear weapons, organized by the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, to begin to re-engage public health professionals around the world who have sort of thought that this is an issue that's behind us, but obviously far from it. So we think that the only solution there really is, and which we continue to stress here in APHA and PSR and IPPNW, is that we need to have abolition of nuclear weapons, something that has been resisted by the nuclear powers, but as you can see is supported by many mainline health organizations, including APHA. And in order to raise the awareness among health professionals, which is indeed abated since a time when PSR chapters really spontaneously rose up around the country, we've been organizing with international organizations such as the International Red Cross and Red Crescent, who have just in 2010 finally taken a position at the international level calling for nuclear abolition, which was reinforced in this document that came out in November of 2011. And our present organizing efforts are trying to get our national Red Cross in line with the international, and we're engaged right now in a campaign where those of us, like myself in San Francisco and in chapters around the country, are trying to now go and talk to the local Red Crosses and to try to make a movement to be in line with the international, which we would hope would have major effect on being able to galvanize the type of opposition that we need. So that's an ongoing thing. We'll see how that goes. At the same time, here at APHA, we have, over the last 2 decades, had numerous resolutions on various aspects of nuclear weapons, to call for an end to nuclear weapons testing, to call for an end of new nuclear weapons programs in the Department of Energy, and as well focusing on the impacts of continued significant budgetary expenditures on nuclear weapons, how they impact the delivery of public health here in our own country. And in 2009, many, based on this past policy, we developed a more comprehensive approach towards these issues of war, partnering with parts, components of APHA, such as the International Health Sections and others, to have a more comprehensive approach, which was the position paper, The Role of Public Health Practitioners, Academics, and Advocates in Relation to Armed Conflict and War. And we've had a number of sessions flowing from the adoption of this as policy by APHA to follow up, to engage public health professionals, not only within our organization to take these issues on more broadly, but to think of ways, how do we bring this back to our own communities, to our own public health and medical schools around the country, to engage with these issues with our communities, because the fact that APHA supports this has a lot of impact as being one of the oldest and the largest public health organization in the world. And our Peace Caucus program has taken this on. This is from the our present issue. We've had roundtables like yesterday to bring people together to deal with different facets of doing this type of outreach. And I'll just give some examples of how we're trying to engage people. This is from Shelley White, who couldn't be here today, but she presented a number of years ago this paper that she presented. This is just one of her slides that I thank her for, that she's done this survey of, well, what's the uptake in public health schools? Well, she surveyed 20 schools of public health, and you could sort of follow this down. There are so few courses in these top 20 public health schools at all dealing with issues of war, and so few dealing with primary prevention, none on the impacts of military spending, illustrating our task. And one of our roundtables and the people involved are developing ways, how do we develop the curriculum, how do we get it out in these various schools. Others, and I'm sorry, Anne, that I stole your thunder, took one of your slides, but if, for example, we've been doing a lot of work, and Anne is going to fill in much more detail what the impact of all of this is on veterans and veterans' health, and this wonderful slide I got from her indicates those issues such as PTSD and others. And we're very happy to report that, as also as one of our ongoing projects, Amy Hagopian, and this is one of her slides as well, of the International Health Section, We worked together to develop her resolution that was passed yesterday. I don't know if you could read this, but that APHA calls for the cessation of military recruiting in high schools. This has been a major effort that she's been working on for 2 years, and it passed yesterday in the governing council with 78% of the vote, despite the fact that there were many barriers to getting this out. And this is, a major thing that we could take back to our communities as an example to develop similar policy around the country. So a lot, there are many related issues, and just to go back in time to some of the positions that our organization has taken, not only against nuclear weapons, but we also have to build on the opposition that we have rooted within our own organization, understanding the implications of the military budget on world peace and what the costs are for various public health programs, this being a 1979 resolution that was passed. Jack Geiger, at the closing session in 1985, underscored how these budgets, which is our continued problem here, are being paid at the expense of fundamental public health and health delivery systems in our country. Basically mirroring the insights that were relayed by President Eisenhower back in 1953 that has become well known, often presented here, that every gun that is made, every rocket fired, signifies in the final sense a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and not clothed, illustrating the important global public health issues related to global military spending. Certainly here we've been reminded by a number of works by Joseph Stiglitz and his co-author, dealing with what is now probably a $4 trillion war. If we look at the impacts of the budgets for which were off budget in terms of the way they were dealt with, of the price tag for the Iraq and Afghan wars, which includes, and probably a great underestimate of what the real costs are going to be able to deal with veterans' health and the polytrauma and the traumatic brain injury and all these other things that we will be dealing with as a society. Well, of course, we're only talking about our boys and women in terms of the veterans, leaving aside the significant global health burden by those wars in those countries. And we continue to have significant expenditures for the nuclear weapons. President Obama, despite his rhetoric, has supported a program now to spend approximately $180 billion by the end of the decade for new Department of Energy nuclear modernization programs, as well as being able to develop the delivery systems for such weapons, even leading the New York Times to comment within the last few months about the bloated nuclear weapons budget and how that has to come down. So one of our challenges, of course, is not only to organize here among the people who come here, but how do we build a new generation? Many, when I give grand rounds on nuclear weapons in medical schools or public health schools, it really hits me between the eyes that many of the students that I'm talking to, they're born in the Clinton administration. They don't really have the sort of appreciation for the dangers of nuclear weapons that many of us here had. And many of the, for example, illustrated here, because, as we know, they're seeing the impacts of the budgetary cuts in their hospitals, et cetera. They have it in their face, the issues that are really hitting them. What are the impacts of these budgets? As these students in Occupy New York, who are the doctors for the 99%, very much reminds me when I was going to medical school at Einstein in the early 70s, and I had the good fortune to have Vic Seidel as my professor of community medicine, who would show this, because this is what the Bronx that I grew up in, and seeing at the impact that he showed at the time what the impact of such military spending would be. And certainly many of the students are well aware of the impacts on healthcare, as illustrated by these figures from the National Priorities Project, that of the total, and this is the total defense spending in fiscal year 2010, over $700 billion, and that's really an underestimate, could provide 207 million people with health care for 1 year, or 310,000 children as well. So just to wrap it up here, we see that what we have to really deal with is well understood and spoken to by Martin Luther King Jr. During the time of the Vietnam War, who made this famous quote speaking at the Riverside Church in 1967, "A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. And I think all of us need, as public health professionals, to really use our credibility to take leadership on these issues and to really underscore that with nuclear war and our whole century of militarism that is now going into a new one, our only there's no cure but prevention. And that's the heart of APHA, and I would submit to you that's a struggle that we need to take on. Thank you.